Okay, we'll go on to maps. Most people here are going to be working on the late 19th and 20th century maps, 20th century period. So really I'm restricting what I'm going to say to maps from the sort of 1840s onwards. And I'm not going to say a great deal about Ordnance Survey maps because we all know what Ordnance Survey maps are and they are available in various different periods. What I'm going to be talking about are types of maps where there is other material which can go along with that map and can tell you a huge amount about that. I'm not going to talk about using modern maps to reconstruct a medieval landscape either. So I'm going to start off by talking about tithe maps. The tithe was a form of tax which in the medieval period was payable to the church. When at the Reformation Henry VIII decided that he was going to ban any payments to Rome, then the money went to the Anglican church. And tithes were levied at the rate of one-tenth of the produce of the land, and that is all the produce of the land. It's one-tenth of your crops, it's one-tenth of your new animals that are born, your lambs and your sheep and cattle and things. It's one-tenth of apples, it's one-tenth of your cabbages, it's one-tenth of your milk, it's one-tenth of your wool, it's one-tenth of the honey that your bees are producing, it's one-tenth of absolutely everything. And when we come on to the 18th century and the 19th century, the tithe becomes particularly contentious. And it's contentious for a number of reasons. Firstly, since the Reformation, before the Reformation, a lot of tithes went to monastic houses. At the Reformation, the right to actually keep those tithes was purchased by laymen, wealthy individuals. And there was a bit of resentment that you don't really mind to some extent paying your tithe to the church, but why should you pay it to the rich man who lives 40 miles away and happens to own your tithe? So it's a bit of resentment on that. But the other forms of resentment were the fact that nonconformity is growing. The nonconformists are paying for their own church, they're paying for their own ministers. They don't see why they should pay for the Church of England ministers as well. You've also got the movement for the enclosure of land, whereby instead of having the large open fields that are farmed in common, that everybody has a share in and that the poor can go in and glean the corn, these are taken into private ownership at enclosure. And you've got a bit of an issue there, because once you take it into private ownership, you want to start improving your land. You want to put some drainage in. You want to just farm sheep rather than crops as well. You want to perhaps introduce selective breeding, which starts to come in from the 18th century. And you're paying a tax, a tithe, on the improvement that you're actually making, because you're making that improvement to actually, you know, earn more money, to get a better return, get a better yield from your crops, to get better animals and whatever, so that your animals are worth more, and you're actually paying a tithe on that increase in value. So they're resented for that reason. Now, what actually happens from the 1750s or so, when land is enclosed by a parliamentary enclosure award, which happens in about half of Leicestershire parishes, the tithe at that time is generally extinguished at that point. And what actually happens is that a certain element of the land that's being taken into private ownership is given to the church. So that from that period onwards, instead of paying a tenth of the value of your produce of your land, you're actually losing probably about one-seventh or one-eighth of your land to the church. And the reason it's not a tenth is because the church is in a very strong negotiating position, because everybody wants to get rid of their tithes. But you've got some land that's enclosed before parliamentary enclosure gets underway, and that land still has tithes on it. And tithes are actually payable. It's easy to think of it as being a medieval tax, but tithes actually continue to be paid until 1996. So it's actually very, very recently that tithes were no longer paid. And what actually happens, in 1833, you get something called the Tithe Commutation Act. Now, what that does, it doesn't actually extinguish tithes. It just turns the tithe from a payment in sheaves of corn and newborn lambs and milk and things to an actual cash payment. And because of that, you get what are called tithe maps. Now, the tithe maps are absolutely wonderful. The point of the tithe map was it actually defined a piece of land that paid the tithe, and it determined how much cash that piece of land would actually pay. And it's actually a variable cash rate because it ties into the market value of grain and things. It's quite complex. And one of the things that I've actually put on that handout, some details of the link there to Leicestershire History. That's the tithe page. It gives you a little bit of detail if you actually want to know the complex nature of how it was actually converted to a cash payment. But what actually happens, you produce these maps on a very, very large scale, sort of 3 or 4 chains to the inch, which is chain is 22 yards, so they're absolutely enormous, great big maps, delineate every property precisely, because the whole point of this map is the fact that tithes would continue to exist, It was thought at that time they would continue to exist forever, and they needed to have a map that defined the property boundaries so that they could stand up in a court of law if necessary. So you get a complete survey of every village. If you're not in an estate village, it is probably the earliest map of that village, earliest map of that piece of land. Delineates the property exactly, and there's a schedule that goes with it, which actually tells you who owns a piece of land, who occupies it, what they're doing with it, whether it's pasture, whether it's arable, whether it's a house, whether it's got outbuildings, or whatever. And I'll just come on and show you a picture of these. Now, there's about 150 tithe maps for Leicestershire. I think it's about just over 150. This one here is for Lutterworth. Now, there are tithe maps and tithe maps. Because tithes are only dealing with the land that hasn't been enclosed, where they haven't been extinguished by Act of Parliament, they only tend to show the land where tithe was still payable. And the tithe maps have come in about the 1840s. They're a result of the 1833 Act. They start in the 1840s. This is Lutterworth. But the only places where tithe are payable are these small areas here and a couple of areas down here, and you can't really see much of Lutterworth. So it's not really much use. But if you get a tithe map that's good, this is a tithe map of Broughton Astley. Now, Broughton Astley Parish, it covers the whole parish. You've got three settlements. You've got Broughton Astley Village, you've got Primethorpe Village, you've got Sutton in the Elmers Village. Every single piece of land has a number against it, which ties in with the schedule. Every property has a number against it. Even these things which are just houses with gardens has a number against it, which ties in with the schedule. So you've got a huge amount of information in there. 1844, this map is. It's three chains to the inch. And if we look at, for example, the property down here, number 406, just down by the river, you say, OK, what sort of details have we got? And I've picked that one because I can just show you what details we have. And this is the one that I've also put on that website. Number 406, owned by James Pegg, occupied by James Pegg. It's a house, it's a blacksmith's shop, it's a peat house, there's an outbuilding, there's yard, there's gardens. We can also see James Pegg owns various other pieces of land. These are the numbers, you can look for them on the map, a little bit away from his cottage. So we know James Pegg was a blacksmith. We know he's got some meadows, so he's got some livestock. We know he's got three lots of arable fields. We know how many acres he's got, acres, roofs and perches. We know how much tithe he's paying in pounds, shillings and pence. So we know a huge amount there about James Pegg. These are absolutely wonderful records when you've got them. I say it's 156, 157, something like that in Leicestershire. If you've got one for the area you're looking at, they are absolutely superb. So if you're a family historian, you know, this is like jackpot, isn't it? You know, you've got everything you want. You've not only have you got your ancestor, but you actually know where he lived, you know what sort of house he's got, you know what sort of land he's got. If you're a local history group interested in helping family historians, again, it's wonderful. If you're a local history group with wider interests, again, you can reconstruct your village, you can do all sorts of things. You can actually, this is 1844, it ties in with the sort of very earliest useful trade directories, which for Leicestershire will be 1846, White's Directory. You can look at how much meadow you've got in your parish, how much arable land you've got in your parish. You can compare that with what farming's like today, what farming's like in the intervening period. You can look at, you can see that you've got people like James Pegg who are actually doing farming and they're carrying on a trade at the same time. You can look at all the trades you've got in your village. You can look at an absolute huge amount there. You can even, because you've got... The next period when we actually get this amount of detail is 1910. So that's the next thing that I want to go on and look at. The 1910 Finance Act is something which stemmed from the 1909 budget. This is the so-called People's Budget of the Liberal Government. This is the one that people that know about early 20th century history have heard about, because this is the budget that was very, very controversial. It was a distributive budget, and one of the things that they wanted to introduce in that budget was a tax on land and buildings, whereby when you sold your land and buildings, you paid a tax of 20% on the increase in value since 1909-1910. Now, there were supposed to be various exemptions for agricultural land if it was only worth agricultural value, and for owner-occupied property with less than 50 acres. So if you just own your house, you know, the tax wouldn't affect you. But, of course, this is a period when very few people did own their own houses. You've got estate villages. You've got very few landowners owning huge quantities of the countryside. And therefore, to actually find out about this tax, you've actually got to actually revalue everything in the countryside. Now, this was incredibly controversial, and the House of Lords rejected it. And this is where you get the whole constitutional crisis that we've perhaps all heard of, where the House of Lords rejects the Finance Act 1909, and they say, well, we'll pass it if you go to the public and have a general election, and if you get a mandate from the public to actually do this Finance Act, then we'll pass it at that point. So the Liberal government then goes to the country again in 1910, gets re-elected in 1910, reintroduces this in 1910, and it's passed that time round, against the threat that a whole load of new Liberal peers were going to be created and that the House of Lords were going to flood the Liberal peers to actually push it through. And, you know, the result of this was actually the Parliament Act, which we now have, which says that the House of Lords cannot veto any budget of any government. This is where this all stemmed from. But this is a highly controversial proposal. And to actually get this proposal in place and to actually start thinking about this tax, they actually had to have a full valuation of every piece of land in the country, every property, every house. Didn't matter even if it was just a small house with a garden, the sort of house that we all live in today, because in a lot of places they were estate villages and that small house and garden would have been owned by a major landowner and therefore its value would have been taxed. So what we get is a huge amount of information on here. And landowners had to complete a form with all the details of their property, their land, their house, how much land they had, how big their garden was, etc., etc. And there was a fine if you didn't complete this information. And then what they did, they recruited a load of valuation officers. And the valuation officers, armed with this information supplied by the landowner, had to go around and visit every single house, every single property in the whole of England and Wales and check the details off, make sure the people weren't fibbing, make sure the land, measure the land, find out what it was and actually provide a value of it. Now, what we actually get here, for Leicestershire, for everywhere, they actually put the details on an ordnance survey map, and it's a little bit like the tithe map in that they actually annotated the map with various numbers, and there's a schedule which goes along with it. Very, very intrusive process, very unpopular process. They even want to know what sort of rooms you've got in your house and that sort of thing, which we'll see in a minute. Must have cost an absolute fortune. I mean, you imagine it today. You know, we talk about this mansion tax possibly coming in. You know, can you imagine actually going around and valuing every house? I mean, what does it cost? You know, they actually repealed most of the taxes in 1920. They couldn't possibly have collected in as much as it cost to actually introduce it, I wouldn't have thought. But there you go. The records are split into two places. They're generally, some of them are at the local record office, some of them are at the National Archives. And if you want to actually go into what there is, because this is a huge amount of information which I'll show you, you need to start by identifying. You've got your map, you look at the things here, and what else there is, there's some information about each of these properties. Now, the landowner filled in a form, as I've said. What they did, they seemed to be an incredibly labour-intensive process, whereby they copied all the information onto a form into one of their own forms, and then they copied it from their own form into a big book, and then they also copied it from the form into a little field book where they went out on their field surveys. So there are four versions of this form. Now, the one that the landowner actually wrote out in his own hand, that's been binned, doesn't exist, or doesn't exist for most places, but the others do exist. So what we've got, first of all, you have to find your parish. Now, these are the land duties books, which in Leicestershire are DE2072, and there's a big catalogue of them. So you find your parish on here. Now, these are what are known as income tax parishes. They're not ecclesiastical parishes, they're not civil parishes. There's roughly two income tax parishes per civil parish, but as you can see, there's a lot of places which they put in together. They're not cross-referenced. So if you wanted Osbaston, for example, you'd have to look through all the places near Osbaston to try and find out where it was if it didn't come under O. They're more or less alphabetical, but Lovenham, for some reason, comes the wrong side a little bad. Go on to some other things here. If you want to look at a particular piece of land on a map, say, for example, you want to know, I mean, my house is sort of somewhere down here in 597 or something. I mean, if you actually want to look at the history of a specific house, want to know who owned it, which farm it was part of, if it was once in the fields, you've actually got to try and sort out whereabouts it is on an OS map before you can actually to go to these maps and have a look at it. Or you might want to look at the history of a field or a playing field or whatever. Get a Map is quite a useful source for that, and again I've put the link on the site. All you have to do is go into, click here to get your map. When it loads, it brings it up to a page. Now you don't actually have to register with this. It's not one of these sites where you have to have yet another password and yet another email address or sign in thing. You can actually visit as a guest. So you actually go in there, visit as a guest. And then what you can do, you can actually zoom in on this map to find the place you're interested in. Now what actually happens, the little orange spot stays in the middle and it's the map that moves. So you move your map so you get somewhere around here. And then you start zooming in. And you've actually got OS maps somewhere. Here. Keep my little spot here. And then we zoom in a bit. And I say, okay, there's a big playing field here. What if I actually want to know that? And you can actually zoom right in, because it'll actually take you into, if you want to look at a house or something like that, it actually takes you into rows and you can actually see houses and things like that. But if I want to look at this playing field here, and you're not terribly sure what you want, you've got a possibility of the leisure map is the ordinary OS map, or the aerial photograph there gives you an aerial photograph of the site. So you can actually say, okay, I'm interested in this playing field, where is it? And you just send your orange dot on whatever you're interested in, and if you notice, you've got the grid reference here. So if you're actually interested in something and you want to find it on the map, and it was a map where it was just fields and you haven't got a clue which field it was, you can actually go to Get a Map and you can actually find it, and it will give you the grid reference for there. Now you cannot actually go from your grid reference to the 1910 maps, because it's very difficult to sort out grid references on there, because you haven't got grids on there, and it doesn't really tie in very well anyway. But what you can do, you can go to the early, immediately post Second World War 2.5-inch map, when modern housing wasn't there. And you can do that because those are now online here. Not a site you've probably thought of using. National Library of Scotland. Anybody here use the website of the National Library of Scotland? Probably not. You wouldn't think of it. Maps of Scotland, county maps, site maps, series maps and things. We actually go onto series maps. It has a map, has just about every map that's been produced of Scotland is on here, actually. It's an absolutely amazing site if you're interested in Scotland. But we're not. But if you go into series maps, as you see, most of these are of Scotland, but what we do have, Ordnance Survey 1 to 25,000, that's a 2.5-inch map, Great Britain 1937 to 1961, 2,000 sheets, that's the whole of Great Britain on there. So if we click onto there, what you can then do, if you go onto there and do View the Maps as a Seamless Layer on Google Maps Base, and it comes up with a search screen, and you've got a find a place, and basically you just type in something in here. So if we typed in, for example, if we typed in something like Matlock, for sake of argument.
Something for the Derbyshire people after the last
Then we've got Matlock. So you've got the 2.5-inch map here. You've got various choices that you can do. This is the 1 to 25,000, 1937 to 51. If you want the OS 1-inch, you can go to that. You can, I think, you can drag the map down if it's not quite what you want. So, you know, you've got your Matlock, Bath, Cromford, that sort of area. Whichever you want. And you can use these to actually identify fields and that sort of thing. And then from the fields, you can actually go to those maps. So that's just another resource which I didn't even know existed until a couple of weeks ago. And somebody said to me, have you looked at the National Library of Scotland? I said, no, what do I do that for? I said, oh, they've got maps in Leicestershire. Oh, okay. Not what I would have thought of. So that's just another useful site.